a noisy world, I think it's right to call it noisy, isn't it, Ron? Regulating collective management organisations. You'd like to live dangerously.
It's one of the less exciting titles you've ever seen, I have to say. Okay, thank you very much, Alison. You'll be aware that all academics suffer from imposter syndrome. We are constantly plagued by the fear that we have no business saying what we claim to know.
Not just academics.
No, well, right, yes. But I'd like to present myself as a fraud by two. On the one hand, I'm reporting, as you can see, work that is done jointly with Simone Schroff. And much of the work that is of real interest in this paper is hers. Unlike Daniel, though, she's not, his co-researchers are not present, are present, she's not. She's escaped to Japan. So I'm left rather exposed. And the second element of my fraudulence is that I realised I think I am the only speaker with absolutely no training in economics who is presenting at this event. So if anybody's capacity is being built round here, it's probably mine. But I don't want to think you're, I don't want you to think you're wasting your time having been told all of that. What I think we have got to offer, which I think is valuable in the context of what we're doing here, is the thought about how comparative study around issues of copyright, creativity and competition can provide useful and revealing insights that can be deployed, I think in the project we're doing, but in other projects of similar kind. So I hope at least my reason for being here has some merit. Let me explain what the background to this research, or the background to what this paper involves, is a question about intermediaries. They're picking up things that Morton and others were talking about yesterday, and the extent to which those intermediaries contribute to the activities of culture and creative industries. And in particular, we're talking about the CMOs, or the collecting societies, collective management organisations, collecting societies, those national and indeed natural monopolies in most countries who collect and distribute the royalties on behalf of right holders and license those rights to users. Now, it is actually the case that these organisations, which I think are becoming increasingly important in particularly in digitised creative industries, have been neglected, and two of the leading authorities on that, on CMOs, are actually present here, Martin and Ruth, and they certainly haven't neglected CMOs. But I think more generally within the legal and copyright literature, they haven't received that much attention. And in the literature I know better, which is the literature around the music industry written from other disciplines, they are almost totally neglected. I mean, you look through most of the indexes of most books that claim to be about the music industry, and the CMO or collecting society barely puts in a presence. But that seems to is clearly a mistake, in the sense that in the policy world, the CMO is attracting increasing attention. The Hargreaves report on copyright reform in the UK drew attention to the need to revisit the regulation of these organisations, and a directive issued last year by the EU to be implemented in 2016 is about creating a framework for the regulation and operation of these organisations, and that's something about which I'm going to talk today. What I think is thrown up by the CMO and our examination of it in the context of creativity and competition are a number of themes, but in particular their general contribution to the notion, to the cultural life of a country and so on. There, what happens when you introduce competition into the behaviour of CMOs, and thirdly, how we might establish what their performance consists in and whether it contributes or not to the world we're examining. As I say, the background to this is a CREATE project, which I've done with Simone, but prior to Simone joining, I worked with Dave Lang, and he deserves some of the credit or blame for what follows. We've been concerned with two things. One has been the directive, which sort of coincided with the project, and the question of what its possible impact might be on things like the small repertoires of countries outside of the kind of Anglo-American field, and the issues of cultural diversity as they might apply to our understanding of what Europe, at least, is offering in terms of musical choice and so forth. The other thing that's been interesting is the ways in which comparative study of organisations like CMO is revealing, and how we found ourselves drawn in a variety of directions, not just comparing European ones with the US, but also in China, where that the issue of the CMO has become quite highly salient. There is the CMOs in China have been incredibly ineffective, and what's happening now is an attempt to bolster their role and to give them more importance, and they are looking to Europe to find models of best practice for those organisations. Okay, the background to this is a thought that somehow, in thinking about the role that CMOs play in the creative industries, the cultural life of countries, is some theory about under what conditions does creativity occur. So I give you first a quote from Fergal Sharkey, probably best known to anybody here as the lead singer of The Undertones, the author of Teenage Kicks, one of the greatest songs ever recorded. Here, writing in the capacity as CEO of UK Music, this is not how you imagine punk careers normally to play out, but there's a kind of double irony. A, you have this punk singer now heading up a major lobby organisation for the music industry, but also you have him writing of this sort of free creative spirit scribbling away, whilst actually in the foreword to a document which is all about major reforms to the British governmental system in order to achieve that creativity. So this, as it were, that's one of the kind of ideals that haunts us. You know, is this really how creativity happens? Well, no, it doesn't, obviously. It's competition. A wonderful piece that I couldn't resist offering you a quote from, on how the Beatles are to be explained and understood as the product of competition. Competitiveness being the incentives that led the Beatles to outperform their rivals. And I think, actually, this idea that competition is a key ingredient, something that George emphasised, I think, very strongly yesterday, is very important to the understanding of what creativity might involve. Although, of course, musicians and others will always talk about themselves as being part of some great big family, it's quite obviously entirely the opposite. But that idea that creativity flows from the competitiveness of artists is, of course, something shared by policymakers. And here are three illustrative quotations or titles which draw attention to the ways in which both the European Union in its thoughts about what it is that copyright is expected to achieve and how it might achieve creativity through competition. Liberating Creativity, which is the report that Fergal Sharkey was writing the introduction to, is called Liberating Creativity. And the clearest sense that you're getting there is that competition, the free market at least, is there in order to enable creativity to take place. And then there's Vince Cable speaking only very recently about how competition and creativity around entrepreneurs are linked. There's a strong kind of follow-through on this idea of competitive creativity in the policies that are adopted by the policymakers of various kinds, or those who seek to influence those policymakers. Now, what is going on for someone like me is the thought that this idea of where creativity comes from contrasts very dramatically with what you might expect, what you find if you read what you might call the sociological or the cultural studies literature on creativity, in which, to borrow Stanley Lieberson's labelling, it's called reflection theory. That creativity is a product of context and conditions, so that if one wants to explain why does punk emerge in the late 1970s in the UK, you look to the social conditions that were affecting young people who happened to become musicians at that time. And if you read much of the kind of history of periods, decades of the UK or any other country, often an account will be given of the cultural changes in terms of the social conditions, the political conditions, the economic conditions that are fashioning those times. That creativity, therefore, is in some sense a product of, not competition, but conditions that people experience and therefore in some way or other reflect in what they create. And so changes in creativity are products of changing social conditions rather than competition. That's the Sex Pistols, if anyone cares. Now, that theory, as I say, reflection theory, was itself very interestingly challenged by a sociologist, Stanley Lieberson, who made a very detailed study of a kind that I think Joel would respect and enjoy, maybe even knows, of why it is people choose certain names for their children. And what he did is he studied the fashions in names. And he was wondering whether, in fact, people changed the names of their firstborn or subsequent children in terms of what's currently fashionable. You know, so Adolf becomes rather unpopular at certain times. Marilyn, Taylor, or Madonna become more popular at other times. Turns out that's not the case. Turns out that there is no neat correlation between social condition and experience, in fact, and name changing. It's an internally generated mechanism. It has something else to do with what actually, it's not these external conditions. They make no difference at all. So he's kind of discounting the reflection theory. And this is the kind of model that I think you find emerging in a certain tradition of understanding how creativity and innovation takes place within the music industry, fashioned by Richard Peterson, kind of industrial sociologist, who writes what became or becomes a very famous article called Why 1955, which is asking why does rock and roll take place in a particular time? And his answer isn't it is the social conditions, it isn't the particular experiences of the United States in that time. It is to do with very interesting and significant changes in things like copyright, in the institutional forms that the music industry takes at particular times and the kind of agencies who are involved in it. So what this is suggesting is that the way in which musical innovation, creativity, and notice I'm using here the idea of creativity not in terms of popularity but in terms of innovation, because I think that's what the literature of this kind is trying to talk about, is understanding it in terms of the possibility that institutional forms are going to be significant, are going to make a real difference. And, of course, there is this kind of work then gives rise to others who seek to map this process. They seek to show that innovation in music, in particular, is a product of particular kinds of market institution arrangements, measured crudely in terms of the concentration of those industries and the degree to which that concentration tends to narrow the range of choices which musicians have or make, and the kind of music to which people can hear. In other words, can hear. So this is not so much about what music is popular, but how music becomes more or less different in certain conditions. And over time, there have been different studies which have tried to map this, and this is a very crude matrix illustrating those, starting with Peterson and Berger saying that they looked at changing how many new artists appear in the top 10 over a particular period, how many companies are in the market. Others seek to refine this basic method, which is looking at the top 10, looking at the organisation of the industry, and trying to see how much that top 10 changes over time in a way that indicates that innovation is taking place in the creative industries. These, as I say, get varied. Each of those I'm trying to illustrate in a very crude way. What are they measuring as innovation? What are they using as the key factor to explain it? And these get more subtle. The measures change from just new artists to the ethnicity of the artists, who are the number of debuts, measuring things like radio plays, but looking at the role that intermediaries like Walmart and others play. I put Joel up here because I don't know that he properly... I think what he's doing is so different and so more innovative than much of what these others have provided, but all of them, I think, are in some ways rather telling us important things about how musical industry or industrial structures are, in some ways or other, shaping content and in terms which I think we might use as innovative or innovation and creativity rather than that. Now, it seems there are limitations to these approaches that I would just want to draw your attention to. One is, as I've revealed, there is no single method or theory or measure of what it is we actually mean by creativity. Each of those contributors is drawing attention to a new measure or a different way of refining this question. For the most part, almost all of those studies, the one noticed was Christina, who looks at the Dutch music industry, are US in focus. So there is no, as it were, sense of the comparative nature of this study that might be involved. The primary focus is on charts and sales as it were, where we find innovation, how we measure it. Innovation, for the most part, as I say, is new artists. In other words, it's assumed that having a new artist is, in some sense, an innovation. The only person who tries to break with that is Lena, who uses different kind of generic types and structures as ways of measuring innovation. And, as I say, almost all of these studies are confined to the United States and to a single country, and for the most part, with some, as notable exceptions, say little about the intermediaries who might in some way or other be contributing to it. And it's against that kind of background that we started asking questions, well, could we say anything in this context, given the idea that copyright is there to incentivise creativity? Could we say anything useful about the role that CMOs play in promoting or in helping creativity or innovation in this case, in the music industry? And, of course, the problems we were facing, exactly the same problems that those I've just described were facing, what measures, whose interests would we want to study and what methods might be used to do so. There have been, and one of the ways we've tried to approach this is to look at what terms those policymakers are using to themselves describe innovation. And one of the things it's interesting to do is to note, if you go through different kinds of policy documents, to see how many different words are used to describe innovation or creativity. And what is obvious from that is that these are very different in what they imply and what they suggest. Diversity and creativity are not, I think, by definition, synonyms. And therefore, there is something interesting to going on in the way policymakers are doing this. There's work that Sean and I and other colleagues have done, which is trying to look at how different in the television industry the awarding of prizes can be mapped onto the structure of the television industries, and to see whether the format of those television industries, the presence particularly of public service broadcasting, changes what might be described as the presence of quality television measured in terms of those that win prizes. And that does seem to be an interesting and revealing way of getting at how institutional contributions are made to innovation and novelty. And in that similar spirit, we were looking in this project at what we might see as the differences between the contribution that CMOs make and the possible impact of the directive, which I'll say something very briefly about in a minute, on those organisations. The sort of thing that gets thrown up by this study in our attempt to kind of treat it systematically is the issues of, and I will run through these extremely briefly, you know, that tension that I've already drawn your attention to the difference between what is meant by diversity, cultural diversity, which is often presented as the good to which policymakers are directed, and creativity. And I think there is an ongoing tension in the way in which public policy uses those two terms. There is an ongoing concern about what happens to what are called marginal repertoires, those repertoires that aren't, as it were, part of the dominant cultural norms. There's the cost of solidarity. Now, this is what a term that Martin Kretschmer uses to describe the ways in which CMOs in particular contribute to other goods than those of their right holders or directly to individual right holders by subsidising other forms of musical creativity or supporting artists after retirement or whatever it is. And that this is threatened by the way CMOs work. There is an interesting contrast to be drawn between film and music, which I won't say anything about here, and between weak regulatory regimes and strict regulatory regimes. One of the interesting things that has occurred in the current interest in China about what's happening to the application of copyright principles is that the argument has been made that having a weak copyright regime has in fact fueled creativity in China. And the suggestion of recent work on that subject suggests quite the opposite, that absence of CMOs and others, or effective CMOs, is harming the degree of creativity. The other issue that's kind of coming up for us is that difference between those CMOs who are regulated by statute and those that are regulated by self-regulation. And there is clearly something going on there that we need to be very conscious of. And Simone has recently wanted to draw our attention to different legal traditions and their impact. Anyway, those are the kind of questions that are coming up. This is the EU directive. It's got a snappy title, as you can see. And what this directive is intending to do is find a way of ensuring, particularly in the digitalised economy in which national borders become much less significant, the use of multi-territory licensing and so forth is going to be really important to the effective operation of the European cultural industries. The EU directive, which I say has to be implemented by 2016, is intending to provide a new kind of framework in which those CMOs, those natural monopolies, operate, in which competition is going to become a much more important player. Now, here I'm going to give you a series of quotations from that directive. Article 1, part of the framework designed to contribute to the development and maintenance of creativity. This directive has as its specific and first stated purpose to foster creativity. But as you notice, as you go into paragraph or article 3, the word creativity disappears and the word diversity comes to feature as being, as it were, the goal to which the directive is aimed. And then in paragraph 9, the answer to creativity and or diversity is the governance structures those CMAOs operate to. So there's this kind of link here being made between competition, diversity, creativity, diversity, and then governance. And then you go further through the document. That the ideal that is to be realised in the directive is the aim of a right owner, a right holder rather, to choose the CMO who represents them. A sense of, as it were, competition to be introduced to ensure that those right holders can then select between those CMOs. Secondly, that those CMOs should act in the best collective interests of the right holders they represent. We have here now a principle of democratic accountability being introduced in conjunction with the competitive nature between them. And thirdly, to improve abilities of their members to exercise control of the activities of CMOs. And what we're seeing here is the idea that the key stakeholder in this arrangement is the member. There are other interests, cultural life of the community as a whole, other organisations or interests, users and so forth, who might have connections to those CMAs. But there's a clear sense here of a form of relationship of competition, democratic accountability, in which the member is the key actor. And this, Ruth was talking yesterday about Schumpeter and his role in thinking about creative destruction. But here is Schumpeter, I think, reincarnated in the EU's version of how the CMOs are going to operate, which is exactly as, very similar to the way Schumpeter imagines democracy to operate, i.e. elite competition for the greater good of all. And it's quite interesting to see Schumpeter appearing in this particular guise, but I don't think it adds a great deal to our understanding of what's going on, but I just thought I'd mention it. The second thing that I mentioned here is the thought that the fears that have been generated by the directive, by those who've commented on it from legal scholarship typically, in which they have drawn attention to the fact that it's likely the effect of competition might be, on the one hand, to mean that the small repertoires don't enjoy the same protection as they might once have done, and secondly, that the cultural investment that organisations like CMOs put into the wider structures and of the music industry are threatened because under competition they are unlikely to be of interest to members. That's the thought. Anyway, final thing. Yes? I have 5 minutes. Is that right?
You have got 6, I think. Oh, well, all right.
You're very generous, aren't you? The final thing I want to do is to show you what, as it were, as a first step, we've been trying to do in thinking about what the contribution the CMO might be making and how we might assess that contribution and what impact the directive might have on them by looking at how CMOs in Europe and with occasional reference to the United States, how CMOs actually operate. And the point we wanted to make here is how differently CMOs actually work and that there are all sorts of factors playing in on their performance, which may or may not have positive contributions to the cultural lives of the countries they currently represent, the artists they currently represent, and that they may represent in some future order. Because one of the things that's going to happen is that CMOs will take on responsibility for the repertoires of other countries and so on. What we did is simply to... let me put that more accurately. What Simone did was look, with help from a Spanish speaker, at the reports of five CMOs, UK's PRS, France, Germany, Sweden, and Spain. And they were chosen for particular reasons I can go into if anybody's interested. And we did look at ASCAP in the United States. And what we were trying to do was look at how those essentially similar organisations, how they differed on a range of measures, with a view to then trying to explain whether those the differences we reveal are products of the regulatory regimes they currently operate under, whether it has anything to do with the constitutions, i.e. how the democratic accountability is maintained within current CMOs, and therefore what might be expected to happen in the aftermath of the directive. So what I'm now going to show you is very briefly a series of slides with graphs on and lines on, which tell you how, which I think I want only to serve to say, my goodness, they are different, aren't they? And then, as it were, pick out just very occasionally a point in reference to them.
In four minutes
is fine. That's good. First of all, this is a graph that maps recruitment to these organisations. The organisations have to respond to members, and what you can see is SACEM, the French organisation, recruiting at higher levels and at a greater increase. And there are very different variations of effectiveness in recruitment to members, which we would want to know more about, why it is that difference of effectiveness in drawing in members. The second thing that is really important, particularly in the future order in which CMOs may be competing with each other, is how much they spend in administering those rights and issuing the licences and so forth. And one of the things that we notice is there is considerable variation in the Ministry of Rates. And what you might, and this is a measure here, is what percentage of the income is spent in administration. And what is important, without going into any of the details here, is that, of course, if you are thinking as an artist, who do you want to join, which CMO do you want to join, you might be tempted to think that, as it were, their efficiency rate can be derived from their administration costs. And the lower the administration, the more attractive they would be to a musician. But, of course, that actually disguises lots of other things that are going in to the cost of administration. And actually, the ones with the higher administration rates are often the ones who are making the greater social and cultural contributions to the industry in which they are located. There are also considerable variations in the income that these organisations derive, and there's a fairly standard pattern. This is the Spanish one down here. This is the Swedish one here. These are the Germany, PRS, ASCAP at the top. And you can see there that kind of divide, perhaps, between what the small nations, or whatever you might call them, or the smaller repertoires, or in terms of their international consumption and the other ones. And that's also reflected in the distribution, i.e. how much money get back to rights holders. But they follow a very similar pattern, as you will see. But then you begin to see very different dependencies. You see here Spain depending much more heavily on TV and radio plays for the income they're generating compared to other CMOs and other societies and settings. And then you see, again, a different pattern emerging where we talk about the rights deriving from the mechanical, from the playing of the physical entity. And that, too, is radically different. Here we have the France right at the top, very dependent on that relative to others. And then when you move on to revenues generated via inline, online or internet-based plays, we get a very different pattern again, in which Sweden is one of the top performers. All of these things are going to matter, of course, in a context in which people are choosing CMOs, but also in terms of where a single regulatory framework, or at least expectations of certain general standards, are to be implemented. And the other thing is here the degree to which they depend for that income that they're distributing on plays in foreign countries. And again, you know, at the bottom, those countries you might reasonably expect to be there, although I'm also including Germany. And then finally, what those organisations spend on others, as it were, rather than on their rights holders. And here we see that France and Germany make considerable contributions, whereas PRS is very low in the score. Now, actually, much of that has to do with the requirements that those organisations are currently operating to, the expectation that they will distribute goods of this kind in this way, and this may then add to their administrative costs, etc., and so on. So there are these, what we see as revealing differences, which may have very significant consequences for the ways in which think about the CMO contribution to culture and creativity. And this is it. That's my conclusion. And this is just all what I wanted to do here is to ask, to raise the thought about how you might contribute an understanding of the role that intermediaries play to innovation, the problems that entails, the possibilities of focusing on the particular role that CMOs play, and the kind of evidence that then emerges as you begin that study by comparing very basic details about those organisations and drawing attention to the very different ways in which they respond to the demands in which they find themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Of course, 10 minutes for questions, depending on how desperate you are for your pocket.
I think Booth and Richard Watt and some others have drawn attention to that collective societies are kind of strange kind of types of organizations. Mm. And they have aspects of an insurance company. So when you join, you don't really know where you end up, you know, whether you're becoming a public company or, you know, whether that's your main idea of $10 or pounds a year. And then this aspect of unionization, basically, that at the beginning, one of the rationales you can give is that basically composers banded together to extract better working conditions from exploiters. Mm. So there are two kinds of aspects which are a little bit surprising. Mm. Yeah, they spontaneously came up. So they're both aspects of collective organization in a way. The way they're conceived now mostly is as accountancy operations, basically like a Visa card scheme, basically. Mm. Most efficiently, you have to, you know, get the money from one place to the other place. Mm. And what really matters is the cutoff for you know, you take for your overheads. Mm. So that's it's quite a dramatic shift. Mm. And what's interesting that the pressure for reform, you know, or these functions which the collective societies maybe originally had, comes from outside. So you've got now the new artists organization, whether it's Future of Music Coalition or whether it's Unison in Europe, basically where the artists reorganize themselves collectively outside the collective societies, to lobby the collective societies and the regulators of the collective societies, so that, you know, a greater share of the money from Spotify goes to the primary creators, that more from YouTube goes to the primary creators. That pressure doesn't come from the collective societies, or not in the same way, because they represent a complex group of interests. So I just wonder whether, you agree with that diagnosis that we, you know, we started basically with one thing, and we are now somewhere quite different.
I think that's very, very, very neatly captured. I think it's exactly the case. And what I think. Just say two things about what you were saying, which I think I wholly agree with, is the thought though that the idea is that although they have now become these, as you describe them, accounting organisations who basically channel money through in various ways to various right holders and so forth, that at the same time, kind of policymakers invest them invest them at least into, if you take the policy rhetoric seriously, with the capacity to increase diversity or creativity within Europe, in the case of the EU. And one wonders whether that is what they genuinely think. In other words, that this is what we're dealing with, is a firmly held view that competition of this kind will actually lead to creativity and innovation of the kinds that they seem to be supporting, or whether this is just the rhetoric that you have to use before you simply say this is about getting the single market to work more efficiently in terms of the movement of cash around that system. And in other words, it's not, you know, it's just addressing. I think the second thing to say is that idea that these other threats that CMOs are now facing, both of them, I mean, those pressures, but also the ways in which, you know, record companies themselves are taking on much of the responsibilities that previously might have been dealt with by CMOs, is also squeezing their role. So what we're dealing with here is a kind of fairly complex set of political circumstances in which it seems the CMOs are absolutely delighted with the directive. They don't seem to have any debate about it, or at least whatever lobbying went on has resolved it in their favour. And that makes you suspicious of what, in fact, is going to be who's going to benefit as a result of them, and how much this plays into their own particular agenda and the pressures under which they currently find themselves.
I've got Gerald and I've got Luke.
I think about the American analogs to these. Mm. So first, approximation, as Martin says, they're collecting. I mean, they're just accounting organizations. They're passive. They're really passive participants that just turn the number of spins into a payment. And so I thought, so what could possibly be the role, except perhaps in the initial negotiation of the price, which determines how much payment gets. But then you showed that wonderful graph of with France spending 10 or 12% of its income on God knows what. but if that's redistribution from the successful artists to unsuccessful artists, that could have an effect on you know, various measures of diversity. So I guess the big question is, what are the ones that are spending money on something other, or doing something other than passive turning of the, you know, the translation of the number of spins into a payment?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah. Well, I think that is an important question, and you're right that though to draw attention to the massive that is the kind of major redistributive mechanism, and the extent to which, I mean, the other, have we put up the Italian one? They also make a huge investment in the well-being of their artists and so forth. But I would just wonder whether though the claim that they are simply siphoning money from, you know, from play to right holder is all that they, to the extent that, you know, the CMOs, when you talk to them, are very proud about how fast they are or how effectively they do it as compared to, you know, naming no names, but, you know, there are other CMOs that are thought in some way or other to be, you know, basket cases, and that in some very important sense does actually impede the well-being of artists in ways that are significant in terms of what they can do and how they can earn a living. So, you know, the extent to which they are accounting agencies might sound as if they are simply siphoning money. But, of course, the ways, the fact that they differ so radically in their efficiency or effectiveness or the role they, or the, how they do it, might be significant to the creativity that we find in the countries in which they're responsible. But it's a tentative one. I don't think we know.
Well, John, thank you very much for a really fascinating paper. I mean, I've thought about these things a great deal. And I completely agree with you that there's a whole sort of rhetoric about creativity is completely confused. Whether it means really innovation in what, this, that, the other. I should tell you that there is a literature in cultural economics on cultural diversity, which I can...
Thank you.
which, because after all, cultural diversity comes up in relation to films and subsidy for films and all those kind of things. But I think in this context of the directive, that what they're worried about is small markets. National sort of musics in countries, which don't compete internationally. And, I mean, from the economic point of view, as you know, I've written a lot on this, or tried to write a lot on this. I mean, it seems to me that there are two really big issues in this the economic issues. One is the problem of cherry picking, which is already going on. Cherry picking means that the top... And by the way, you didn't mention the role of publishers at all, which I think is fundamental, because publishers actually, or at least in some of these countries, publishers register the works and so on. They're in control of it because of all the assignment issues. Again, that's something you haven't touched on, whether you have to assign or whether they act as agents and so on and so forth, which I think is also important. But anyway, I mean, cherry-picking means that the top people go for the best deal perceived in whatever terms, whether it's the cheapest, the lowest cost, or whatever, which inevitably raises the cost of administration for those people left behind. And in this case, we're talking about countries getting left behind. If there's true international competition, what will... And I take it we're talking between collecting societies, whereas there's also a threat that big data might get into this anyway, or Google or somebody would have the data to be able to do this. So that's the thing that, again, one should sort of keep bear in mind. So, you know, we've got a situation where these are natural monopolies. The investment that they've had to make for digital... is huge. Small country, when I say small country, I don't mean geographically small, I mean countries that have a small music industry, do not have the wherewithal to make these investments. I think, you know, if you really understand natural monopolies, you realize that this is going to get stronger and stronger. And of course the big ones that you're looking at are very interested in it indeed. I'm sure PRS is, ideally placed. In a grouping with Sweden and Germany, they've got the whole of, most of the European market. So obviously the big ones that can make these investments are likely to be able to capture things if people are looking at administrative costs as the thing to go for. So I think the two of these things, which are very much economic things, which are linked, are really what the concern is. And all this talk about diversity and so on is really, you know, saying that Morton mentioned Albania to me, as one tends to in these kind of, used to be Ruritania, but Albania seems to stand in the, I mean, you know, that they just don't really stand a chance, or they'll have to, you know, do something else to finance their musicians.
Can I just collect another question?
Do that.
You were next, and then Morton, and then we can see when you run out of words.
Oh, mine's quite a different question. Thank you very much, Tom, for your presentation. From what I understand, the comparative element seems to be a core part of your work, and I think it's interesting how you look at the different organizations and see, well, where do they derive most of the money, what kind of uses are they reliant on, and I wonder, do you then also consider, and do you undertake comparative research into the underlying copyright statutory framework? There might be, you know, the different copyright laws might be giving a different role to these organizations. They might be allowed to do different things to a great extent. And in that respect, I also wonder whether they are really, as you say, so passive participants, because the law only gives us a framework, and this is where the new business models kick in. And when you have new types of services like streaming, interactive streaming, I think that creators, I think that collecting societies and collective management organizations actually do have a seat at the table and say, well, okay, let's interpret this type of business model, what use does it fall under, and do we have a role to play in terms of, for example, gathering equitable remuneration? So, I mean, that's basically my question. Do you also study the law and how they're working with the law?
I will answer.
Was it, in a sense, maybe seeing them as slightly different, as a sort of bounty hunters, that you pay for them to go out and find out who's used your music and then bring back some of the loot. And if that's a way of thinking about it, then there are, you might, then the cherry picking means you go for those. Now, you can then possibly understand the cross subsidies that Joel and others have mentioned in that context. So essentially, yeah, the small guys, you're not going to go for that bit of money, but what you are doing is you're spending more time getting the big loot in, and then you cross-subsidize. So there's not, it's a combination of cherry picking and cross-subsidizing, that, which then may make total sense for everybody to buy into that.
Time has run and coffee is beckoning, so I won't. But thank you to all those last three, because what they seem to be saying to me, which is what I think we were kind of gradually sort of sliding towards, is the thought that in order to make this comparative study work effectively and to reveal things that are of genuine interest to the ways in which we understand the role of CMOs and so forth, is to combine this understanding of the legal regimes under which we're working and the differences between those legal regimes, but also the ways in which the kind of market forces to which they're subjected are, as it were, playing out in those terms, and the kind of bounty hunting, cherry picking process clearly needs to be accommodated. And I want to sneak in somewhere into all of that an account of, as I were, the constitutional structures of these, because I pretend to be a political scientist, the constitutional structures that these organisations are responding to and working with, and the extent to which they too are also shaping the ways in which they are going to respond, both the economic pressures and the legal pressures under which they operate. But thank you very much for your patience. Is there a coffee?
I don't know.
Thank you very much, Alison, for chairing.